Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm David Matulipe. It is indeed Valentine's Day, and critic Peter Robinson will be by to offer some historical context and a song or two. Comedian Kurt Bodden might have a thing or two to say about the occasion. He's currently touring with his award-winning solo show, Steve Seabrook, Better Than You, and begins a six-week run here in San Francisco starting next week. To begin with, though, this week, a conversation that has absolutely nothing to do with Valentine's or flowers. British-born composer, writer, and pianist Stephen Hough returns to the Davies Symphony Hall stage as soloist this afternoon and weekend with the San Francisco Symphony, conducted by returning guest conductor Pablo Harris Casado. On a program that includes the West Coast premiere of Magnus Lindberg's Expo and Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, Hough will be performing Liszt's Second Piano Concerto. Stephen is an honorary member of the Royal Academy of Music in London, where he is a visiting professor, and a fellow of the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester, where he is the International Chair of Piano Studies. Among his many and varied honors, he was named by The Economist and Intelligent Life magazines as one of 20 living polymaths in 2009. The year before that, he won the 6th International Poetry Competition. He had a solo exhibition of his paintings at the Broadbent Gallery in London in October of 2012 and is also the first classical musician to receive a MacArthur Fellowship. Time and calendar conspired against us to have him here in studio today, probably because he's off to solve the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians or planning his next dozen concerts somewhere, but I did catch up with him by phone yesterday after his rehearsal for these concerts. Stephen, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
So much we could talk about in so many areas, but first off, how did the rehearsal go?
We had a super rehearsal, actually. You know, this is an interesting piece because it's in a way like one long improvisation, and it has many, many mood changes, tempo changes, and Pablo was fantastic in the orchestra. You know, it's one of the great orchestras in the world, and everything just seemed to gel in the first run-through. In fact, we looked at each other at the end and thought, well, there's very little to say, which is unusual for this piece, because not only isn't it played very much, so it's not in people's bones, but it also, it needs guiding. You know, it needs the changes of tempo and mood need to be paced properly. So I was surprised, but very happy that we got through it today. Of course, I'm tempting fate, aren't I, in a sense, because it can always just get worse and worse and worse. But so far, it's okay.
Well, it's interesting you should say that about that rehearsal. Have you worked with Harris Casado before?
We've just had one time together in Seattle a couple of years ago. We did a Tchaikovsky first concerto there. So I knew that, you know, that he was terrific, and we got on very well then. So I was looking forward to this week tremendously.
Well, it's been said that this Liszt first concerto, an expert keyboard athlete can make a go of the first concerto, but the second is considered for poets. And that seems to fit right in with some of your varied interests.
Yeah, I think it does show two sides of Liszt in a way, although there are some very poetic moments in the first concerto that sometimes get skated over, and there are some very virtuosic moments in this second concerto. But yeah, I think you could say that the first is Liszt the extrovert and the second is Liszt the introvert, if you were going to categorize them like that. They're both very similar. You know, they're both really in one movement and various sections, like a symphonic poem for piano and orchestra without a specific program.
A tone poem with a little bit more piano, perhaps.
Yeah.
You've been exploring the piano concerti of Central European composers. You've got a new Hyperion release coming out, which features the two Brahms piano concertos that you just performed in Salzburg with Mark Wigglesworth and the Salzburg Mozarteum Orchestra. Now, how does Liszt fit into all this exploration?
Well, Liszt has always been part of my pianistic life. I find him a fascinating character. I think, in a way, he's arguably the most important musician of the 19th century, not the most important composer, but he's at the forefront of so many things that came afterwards. He's one of the first composers routinely to conduct other composers' music, so to have a career as a conductor rather than as a, you know, before Liszt, really, composers would go to cities and conduct their own music because no one else knew it. And Liszt changed this. He actually started conducting Berlioz and Wagner and Schumann and so on. He invented the recital. He coined the word. and invented the idea that someone, a pianist, could be on stage by him or herself for a whole evening without other entertainment. He invented the masterclass, the public lesson, which I'm going to do actually this evening at the conservatory here in San Francisco, where people gather around and you give a public lesson. And so on, with the piano itself, you know, he developed the technique of playing the piano more than anyone else, and that in turn pushed piano makers to make the pianos more and more powerful and more the sort of piano that we have today. So, and this is not even touching his influences as a composer. So he's always an interesting person to explore. There's always something to find that you didn't realize was there before.
Well, you're following in his footsteps as well as performing some of your own compositions as you trot the globe.
Yeah, I'm playing my second piano sonata on the present tour. I hesitate to say following in Liszt's footsteps, of course, but it's interesting that until around the 1940s, there aren't any instrumentalists who didn't also compose. I can't think of one. So the idea that you just play the piano and play other people's music is a very, very modern idea. And indeed, in the 19th century, if you went to a town, well, particularly as a conductor, and said, you know, I'm a conductor, and the first thing they would say, well, you know, what music of yours are you going to conduct? You know, the idea that you just performed other people's music is a 20th century phenomenon, really.
You've got an ambitious performance schedule ahead. Speaking of performing now, do you have any favorite concert halls that are included on this tour?
Well, I'm doing a recital at the main stage of Carnegie Hall, which is a favorite place, not just because it's so famous, but it is such a wonderful space to play in. The ghosts, you know, are literally in every corner there of the people who've played there. And it's one of the few halls in the world of its size that also somehow manages to feel intimate. I don't know quite how it does that. I think it's partly the sound, because even just playing a chord in Carnegie Hall gives you something back. The hall is part of the instrument. And that's a thrilling thing to do. But on the other hand, I also enjoy playing in smaller halls too. I think certain repertoire is not suitable in very small halls. In fact, this program that I'm playing, the Brahms Third Piano Sonata, is really a symphony for the piano. And in a small hall, it's too big, not in terms of decibels, but the scope of the piece somehow. It needs a big canvas to make its gestures really telling.
You were talking a little bit about different instruments that you might perform on in a different hall. I'm wondering if you personally have a different instrument choice for, say, a concerto versus a recital performance, or is there maybe a go-to maker that does it all for you these days?
Well, there really is only Steinway. I mean, there are some other companies who make, you know, some wonderful pianos. Fazioli is one. But I think for the sheer, reliability, range, consistency, there's nothing that I've found that will come close to a Steinway. Also, if you're playing a big concerto in a big hall, the Steinway will be heard on the last row. I mean, of course, just saying the Steinway is a little bit deceiving, because every instrument is different, and there are Steinways that are very mellow in sound and rather intimate. But when Steinway is really voiced for that, it's a thrilling experience, and I've not yet found anything to equal it.
I'm embarrassed to say that I have yet to explore many of your some 44 or so CDs you have out. I'm curious about the recording technique. Do you prefer to have the microphone as if you're listening in the hall, or up close so you can get the actual sound of the piano striking, the hammer striking the string, or do you try different ways of recording your sound?
It's a very difficult question, that, because it's difficult to record the piano. I don't think you want to hear the mechanism of the instrument. You don't want to hear hammers literally, you know, going up and down.
Unless you're doing some John Cage or something.
Right, yeah. But I think it depends. I one week, about 15 years ago, I suppose, I recorded both a CD of Mompo piano music and a CD of César Franck piano music. And I didn't want the same sound for both, although we ended up using the same piano for both. The Franck seemed to me to need a much bigger kind of acoustic, you know, not exactly a cathedral, but it needed to feel like that. Whereas Mompo is incredibly small, intimate, miniatures. And I wanted there to feel like it was just one person in a small living room. So that was an example of where we looked very carefully at trying to get two very different kind of sounds in the same hall with the same piano.
Interesting. So moving away from the performances just for a moment, I was just reading the abridged list. I guess there's some sort of a pun intended on that. List of your recent activities makes me wonder, what's your preferred blend of coffee? My goodness.
Well, I gave up coffee 2 years ago.
All right, so it's on to stronger drugs.
It's on to tea, actually.
Tea.
Well, I've always drunk tea, but I drank 2 pints a day of coffee, a pint pretty much as soon as I got up in the morning. And I had to have some medical tests a couple of years ago, and I needed to fast from everything for 12 hours or whatever it was. And I ended up then not having coffee in the morning and then waking up the next morning and, of course, craving my coffee, but feeling less ill, actually. I realized that there was a kind of acidity that coffee had that was making me feel a little bit ill. And then as soon as I had my pint, I'd start to feel well again. And that didn't seem to me a very good thing. So I stopped for another day and then felt even better in the morning. So I've started drinking tea, and I haven't had a cup of coffee in 2 years now.
I might have to take a page out of your playbook for that one. Now, I'm wondering, all of these various activities as painter, as writer, as blogger, are all these compartmentalized, or are they all related to the musical end of your life?
Well, I think everything in the end is related to the musical, but they're all things that I do when I've finished doing my main thing. I think of composing and playing now as closer together, although I spend less time composing than I do playing. But writing words, it's something I'm likely to do on a plane or in a hotel room at night. Painting very much whenever I, usually at home when I finish practicing and I just... I'm tired and frustrated, and I'll go and vent my frustration. I find when I do other things, it makes my playing more exciting to me. I find it, I can't wait to get back to the piano when I've been painting, and I can't wait to get painting when I've been playing the piano. So they all kind of feed off each other. And I think there's some sort of central idea, I suppose, behind it, which is, I think that great art and great musical compositions have a feeling of surprise about them always, and yet at the end of them a feeling of inevitability, that it couldn't have been any other way. If you think of the great works of Brahms or Beethoven or whatever, there's not a bar where it's expected in a way, or, you know, just conventional and boring. But also at the end, this kind of journey you feel you've been on makes total sense. A little bit like reading one of those vast Victorian novels, or a great Dickens novel. At the end, you know, you feel like you've been on this sort of journey. And I think that's in a way what I try to do with everything that I do, that, you know, there's an element of surprise, I hope, about it. Shock, if you like, but not in a way that I'm calculating it. You know, I want to shock people. I think that never quite works in the end. But just, I hope something that comes from inside of me, but that surprises, but at the end has some kind of a connection that makes sense in the bigger picture.
You can catch up with Stephen's multifaceted and fascinating life at stephenhoff.com. That's Stephen with a P-H, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, and Hoff, H-O-U-G-H, stephenhoff.com. And try to catch these San Francisco Symphony concerts if you can. Stephen, I do wish we had some more time to talk, and perhaps I can use that as an invitation to have you back.
I'd love to come back, David. That would be great.
Stephen's concerts with the San Francisco Symphony are this afternoon, right after open air, in fact, 2 o'clock. Tomorrow, the 15th, at 8 o'clock, Saturday at 8, and another matinee on Sunday at 2 p.m. On the program, the second piano concerto of Liszt, San Francisco Symphony, conducted by guest conductor Pablo Harris Casado. On the program, also Expo by Magnus Lindberg, the West Coast premiere of that, and Prokofiev's wonderful Symphony No. 5. Information about those concerts at sfsymphony.org. Here's now a track from Hoff's new CD, Stephen Hoff's French Album, and the music of Claude Debussy. Thank you. Stephen Hoff's French album, Clair de Lune, music of Claude Debussy. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air on this Valentine's Day, 2013.
John! Marcia! John! Marcia! John? Marcia... John! Marcia? John! Marcia!
Marcia, 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 John, 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 John,
Marcia.
John. Marcia.
The great Stan Freberg's sophisticated writing with Cliffy Stone and Orchestra from 1951. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe. It is Valentine's Day 2013. Peter Robinson will be by shortly to offer some literary insight into this manufactured holiday. And people, well, maybe it's time to look inward, to think about, well, how can I be a better me? Right? Well, fortunately, I've got someone here who can help you because, quite frankly, he's better than you. Steve Seabrook, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here. And I want to make it clear, in case you're wondering, that I don't intend to change you today, but perhaps we could support you in becoming a you that's better than you. That's why I call my program Steve Seabrook, Better Than You.
Steve Seabrook, Better Than You. Everyone wants to be better, Stephen. Actually, this is actually... Stephen Seabrook is the num du stage of my guest, Kurt Bodden. Kurt, yes. Welcome to KLW.
Thanks, David.
The show is called Steve Seabrook, Better Than You, playing at the Marsh for a nice six-week run. You've been touring around for quite a bit now. It's kind of a poke, a fun poke, but also a pretty substantial dig at the self-help guru types.
Well, it is, but it's also it's a knowing satire. There's some affection there, too. The show was born of my ambivalence, having had some experience as a client of personal coaching and reading some self-help books and going to the occasional seminar. So there were ways in which I really felt it helped my life. But then in other ways, over time, you just start to hear the same cliches over and over and to start to feel the manipulation that is behind some of it. And so I just had to poke some fun at it. But I'm not making it out to look stupid. There are a lot of comedians who've made fun of the movement, and they tend to take it over the top, and it can be very funny. Chris Farley's one example. But I made a conscious decision with Steve Seabrook that I would only say things that a real motivational speaker would actually say. So it's all in the delivery and that little gleam in the eye that you get the comedy out of it.
So instead of a show, it's actually you're pretending that these are people attending a motivational weekend.
That's right. We set it up that when I come on the stage, I establish that it's Friday evening and we're all here for tonight and for Saturday and Sunday, and we're here for 3 days of self-help. And isn't it great? You know, wow, we're all here. It's fantastic. But at the same time, at 7 o'clock on Friday night, people who feel real good about themselves are not sitting in personal growth workshops. They just aren't. So
true enough.
So I'm walking that line of being supportive and nurturing, and then also batting people down.
Sure. Well, you know, it's phenomenal, the success of some of these programs. I'm thinking of people like Tony Robbins or someone like that. Mm-hmm. It's just, it kind of feeds into always wanting to be a better you, and that's exactly what this show is doing. Now, tell me a little bit about the name Steve Seabrook.
Well, I've found in my, and it's interesting being asked about my name from someone who goes by David LaTulipe, by the way. But Steve came up the first time I did this character in a 3-minute monologue, and I have this moment where Steve says something kind of aggressive to the audience, and then I react with mock horror as if I'm an audience member going, "But Steve!" The first time I did that, I got this huge laugh, and I thought, well, I guess Steve is this guy's name. And then Seabrook just emerged over time with some trial and error.
I see a little bit of maybe Seacrest perhaps influenced there, maybe.
Possibly. Whatever it means to you, David.
My own insecurities coming into play.
It might indicate more about you than about me,
Well,
frankly.
let's talk about me, shall we?
Yes.
How can I be a better me? What can you do for me?
Well, David, don't work too hard at it. You have to, if you're going to step into this space, you have to give yourself some relief. And so, you know, a lot of times we're just revving that engine, pressing on the gas pedal, but first you got to release that brake and just coast for a while.
Wow. I will take that to heart.
So I'm opening a week from Friday for a 6-week run, and it's great to be at the Marsh Theater, which has seen so many terrific solo shows.
That's well, you're no stranger to San Francisco. You've hosted Talk Show Live San Francisco, interviews with some comedy house band, Cocktails at the Purple Onion, of all places. You've got some chops from there. Mm-hmm. And you completed 2 years of conservatory training recently in physical comedy, as well as mime and clowning, and sketch comedy you've done.
Right, and I used to be a company member at Bats Improv and an instructor there. And so it's not just my performing background, but also what went into Steve Seabrook was my background as a corporate trainer and a teacher of improv and an audience warm-up comic at studio tapings in Los Angeles. So I'm able to draw on those skills I have at pulling an audience together and getting them energized and cluing them into what's going on and creating a safe environment and away we go.
Well, in addition to your acting skills, I noticed on your bio that you're named on a couple of patents for office furniture, furniture design. Tell us about that aspect of your life, please.
Right. Well, in my earlier life, I worked for about 10 years as a product designer in architecture and product design firms, and we specialized over time the office where I worked in designing office furniture for manufacturers. And for that matter, I found people say, well, that's a strange transition to go from designed to comedy, but...
I mean, I just think of the whoopee cushion. I mean, right. There's not a stretch there at all.
Yeah, the exploding cigar. The squirting flower. I never thought to turn my design talents to comedic products. But in when you come up with a design, you get that flash of inspiration, and then you labor to kind of make it work, and then you have to present it in a way that the client or your boss understands. And sometimes you have to go through a few iterations where you think, well, this is a great idea, but they aren't getting it. If it didn't go over well, I know the idea is still good, so I just need to work on making it come across better. And that's what I find with comedy, too.
So if the chair comes up, naturally, you're the guy who said, well, it's got to come down as well. Is that what you're saying to us?
I think that might be what I'm saying, yeah. And so I find with comedy material, if a joke doesn't go over well, then I'll work on it if I believe in it, and it's just a matter of changing the setup or the timing or the punchline or the juxtapositions.
Well, that's where the improv skills come in, because every audience is going to be different, of course.
That's true. Yeah, it began very improvisationally, where I started with a short scripted piece, and then as when I was doing stand-up comedy, I would just sort of have a loose outline of where I wanted to go. But I've been working with a director on this show named Mark Kenward, who has a lot of experience directing solo performance, and he from the very start said, well, I have to have a script if I'm going to follow along with you. And I said, well, but it's not written down. That's not how I work. But over time, I've found it's been terrific to really craft and hone these things on the page as well as on the stage.
Well, you've got to at least keep to an outline so he knows what's going on. And then tangents are always a part of the equation.
Okay. Yeah, and I have a lot of components in the Steve Seabrook Better Than You show, so I can also mix and match or drop things one night and add things another, or ad-lib according to what's going on. There's also an actual improvised portion of the show where I take questions from the audience and answer those. So there's a dynamic between me and the audience that you don't typically get in solo shows. I'm not putting the audience on the spot. As someone who enjoys attending a lot of performances, I don't enjoy that much. But I like engaging the audience from the stage and making them feel like their presence and just their focus is part of what makes the show work.
Could you share maybe one of those audience questions that came in that like either threw you for a loop completely or perhaps made you think of things in a different way?
Let's see. It's tough because I improvise them every night. I don't have any questions planted. But there was one recently where someone asked, I lost it. Wait a second. What if I don't feel good about me? And I said, well, maybe you should spend time around others who feel good about you, and maybe it'll wear off over time, or you'll pick that up over time. So that was a quick one. A lot of times they wind up being very long and wide-ranging, but then loop back to the answer. Well, it's a fun part of the show.
How can I make my cat a better cat?
How can you? Well, David, it sounds like there's a power dynamic going on there, where you seem to think that you know what's good for the cat. I've never melded minds with a feline. Maybe you have, but it seems to me that maybe if you can take your hands off and let your cat be the cat, you can find a common ground on which to communicate.
Words to live by. Midge, are you listening? I don't think she's listening at home at the moment.
Midge is your cat.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Maybe I can get Midge a comp to the show. Oh. And that'll make her a better cat.
She'd love it, and she'd love the upholstery, especially if the seats are upholstered.
They are. I'm in the upstairs theater at the Marsh, which is the perfect space for what I'm doing. It's the perfect layout for kind of that seminar context.
Kurt Bodden's award-winning show, Steve Seabrook, Better Than You, starts a six-week run beginning February 22nd, runs through March 30th at the Marsh on Valencia Street, a great space. Information and tickets at themarsh.org. And you can see a little clip of the show and learn a little bit more about what Kurt is up to at his website, kurtbodden.com. That's KURTBODDEN. Kurt, I'd like to maybe invite you to share some Valentine's Day observations.
Now you're putting me on the spot. Because I understand that we have a guest here to talk about Valentine's. I might chip in with something on that.
I'll ask you to stand by, but no, please. I smell something burning over there.
Well, I was going to say that Valentine's Day is a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't holiday. If you have a Valentine, then you feel good about yourself. And if you don't, you might not feel as good about yourself. But even if you do have one, the world seems to be telling you you're not doing enough. And we have actually set aside a day where you simply must do something to make yourself a good lover. Maybe that's something you should go with, or maybe you should find your own day.
I think there are not only books, but devices that can help with those sorts of things. Thank you, Kurt. That's very good. And please do stand by as we talk shortly with Peter Robinson about this rather manufactured holiday. Thanks, Kurt.
Thank you, David.
Yes, let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Our hearts are made of it. Let's take a chance. Why be afraid of it? Bible today, let's close our eyes and make our own paradise. Little we know of it, still we can try to make a go of it. Oh, baby, we might have been meant for each other. To be or not to be, let our hearts discover. Let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Now is the time for it. While we are young, let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Our hearts are made of it. Let's take a chance. Why be afraid of it, honey? Bye for today. Let's close our eyes and make our own paradise. Little we know of it, still we can try to make a go of it. Oh, baby, we might have been men for each other. To be or not to be, let our hearts discover, sweet mama. Oh, baby, let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Now is the time for it. While we're young, let's fall in love.
That never gets old. Louis Armstrong singing the classic Let's Fall in Love. David LaTulipe with you here for Open Air, joined now by Peter Robinson, with Kurt Bodden standing by to perhaps chime in here and there. Peter, happy Valentine's Day to you.
Thank you, David. And I was just catching Steve on the way in the, on the car radio, and I suddenly realized that when you drive in from Marin County, you actually come from the county which has the biggest room in the world, and that's the room for self-improvement. And I nearly got cut off by a guy, so I did manage to get the window down, but he explained to me that he was on a spiritual journey. And I said, oh, there's Marin for you. And then he said, of course, you know, it's the journey and not the destination.
Of course. Okay.
And today is St. Valentine's Day, and here's one tune. It's that great track which came from Casablanca, the film with the mysterious ending. Did Humph make it on the plane, or was he left standing supporting the Foreign Legion? But before that, he asked Sam to hit the keyboard. So here we go.
Just a kiss, a sigh, just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
As Time Goes By, not only from Casablanca, but actually written for a musical called Everybody's Welcome by Herman Hupfeld. How about them apples, Peter?
Well, there we are. Everybody's welcome. And welcome today here to KLW on our celebration of St. Valentine's Day. Now, I've got to add that St. Valentine's Day brings out both the cynic and the romantic in me. The cynic says, who cleans up best on Valentine's Day? And I've concluded it's the good people at Hallmark whose conspiracy with the postal service means it costs the average lover about $10 simply to make the declaration of love. The romantic thinks of those words of Gus Kahn, another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee. And then I wonder how the early Christian martyr, St. Valentine, feels about February the 14th, since the origins of this feast go back to pagan times and have very little to do with the good saint himself. In England, there's always been a traditional belief that St. Valentine's Day is the day that birds, that's the feathered variety, find their mate. But for us mere mortals, I see it not so much as the feathered variety, but I see it as a trance of lovers, a hush of hopes, a rush of feelings, a blush of encounters, a flush of cheeks, a crush of hugs, a mush of love letters, and no doubt a slush of passion. It all begins with a fever of infatuations, maybe a peck on the cheek, and somewhere in the mix, Valentine's Day comes the offering of flowers. In our internet age, you can even send an electronic bouquet. And then when things begin to change, we move into a split of Dutch treats, followed by the chill of commitment. Next comes the tempest of broken promises, and even a winter of farewells, which may end up in a springtime of reconciliations. By February the 15th, the world takes on a different shape, and we form a different state of normality. Individuals who simply care for each other. A kiss goes to prove that two heads are better than one. But one of the great all-time kissers, Inga Bergman, saw the act of kissing as a lovely trick designed by nature to stop speech when words became superfluous. Woody Allen answers his own rhetorical question, is kissing dirty? With the provocative answer, only if you do it right. Songwriters such as Julian Stein got it right both lyrically and musically with, a kiss on the lips is quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. Mae West had a different take, love conquers all except poverty and toothache. Whereas W.H. Auden, being the true philosophical poet that he was, wanted to know, where did love come from? When it comes, will it come without warning, just as I'm picking my nose? Will it knock on my door in the morning, or tread in the bus on my toes? Will it come like a change in the weather? Will its greetings be courteous or rough? Will it alter my life altogether? Oh, tell me the truth about love. However, For me, love can be as simple as reading a poem to each other aloud in bed. But if this sounds a little mushy, let me finish with the down-to-earth observation of Dorothy Parker. As I grow older and older and totter towards the tomb, I care less and less who goes to bed with whom. Well, with these happy thoughts on St. Valentine's Day, I leave St. Valentine himself pondering, what would he be doing? Would he be buying a card at Hallmark? Or would he echo that song, that great country western song from Cynthia Hyman, take your tongue out of your lips, I'm trying to say goodbye.
I'm much too sentimental. My heart is never free. Perhaps it's accidental that love should come to me. Some little thing within me protects me for a while, till someone comes to win me with only a smile. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? Can't help you. Love's always been my game. Play it how I may. I was made that way. Can't help you. To blame. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? Can't help it. Sonst gar nicht.
Me out for something wet. When the vet begins to pet, I cry hooray. But I'm always truly a darling in my fashion. Yes, I'm always truly a darling in my way. I've been asked to have a meal by a big tycoon in steel. If the meal includes a deal, except I may. Truly a darling in my fashion. Yes, I'm always truly a darling in my way. There's an old man known as Tex, who is keen to give me checks. And his checks, I fear, mean the Tex is here to stay. But I'm always truly a darling in my fashion. Yes, I'm always truly a darling. Mr. Thorne calls me up from night to morn. Mr. Thorne wants cornered corn, and that ain't hay. But I'm always truly a darling in my fashion. Yes, I'm always truly a darling in my way. From Milwaukee, Mr. Fritz often dines me at the Ritz. Mr. Fritz invented Schlitz, and Schlitz must pay. But I'm always truly a darling in my fashion. Yes, I'm
Mr. Harris Plutocrat wants to give my cheek a pat. If the Harris pat means a Paris hat, okay. But I'm always true to your darling in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to your darling in my way. I'm always true to your darling.
Couple of great ladies of song for you this Valentine's Day 2013. That was the incomparable Blossom Dearie with the words of Cole Porter, always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Prior to that, Marianne Faithfull, another inimitable voice with Falling in Love Again. David Latulippe here on this Valentine's Day 2013 with Peter Robinson with a fantastic essay on the holiday, and Kurt Bodden to chime in every now and again about some woman's legs or something I hear you guys talking about in between the tunes.
Well, yeah, I mentioned legs because I did see Marlene Dietrich perform that original number, and I think there's something about, I want to say, a European accent, whether it's French and it's Charles Aznavour's voice, or whether we're moving into her kind of guttural Hollywood German. There's just that hesitation and pause about falling in love again that I think is full of suggestion. And, of course, Cole Porter, whose song you played on that second round through, I think really had a turn of phrase for me, just to use his own words. He's the top. And
absolutely.
I think in terms of the Liszt song, whether it's a Paris hat or the Mona Lisa, any of these images that he can create and then have that music to back it up.
Well, I caught in that tune, just towards the end, I had to laugh out loud because when you're talking about the Paris hat, he throws in a little quote of the La Marseillaise, that bum, 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 but just ever so subtly, it's, you know, it's absolutely brilliant.
And How the French Do Love, of course, is another episode all by itself. I mean, which you've given us that old phrase, the French kiss, which I won't define on radio. A couple of lines from Dorothy Parker did strike me as being relevant for today. By the time you swear you're his, shivering and sighing, and he vows his passion is infinite and undenying, lady, make a note of this, one of you is lying.
Very nice. I can match that Dorothy Parker with another one of my favorite quotes, which involves imbibing of a martini. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have the exact words, but it's something along the lines of, "I like a good martini, two at the very most. After three, I'm under the table. After four, I'm under the host."
There we have it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kurt, anything to add to our Dorothy Parker serenade, or on the Valentine's Day front, or perhaps some legs you want to show? Give us a little leg here.
Well, I like that line that your engineer Niels just mentioned, where he said that a Dutch comedian, was it, or a writer, said that with regard to Marlene Dietrich's legs, if my wife had only one of those legs.
Well, gentlemen, any other thoughts about this holiday, perhaps, as we celebrate the giving of cards and roses?
At a moment, when we're ready, I have got a play to review and recommend. And maybe just as a switch to Valentine's Day, the play You Know When the Men Are Gone is put on by Word for Word. Word for Word has an interesting way of presenting things, because they will take a story, in this case it's two short stories, and they will include every word in the text. So if the story says he said or she said, and then they add the adverb knowingly, that is incorporated into the play. This is particularly well done. You Know When the Men Are Gone is really a story about people coming home from the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and how the war at many different levels, from psychological to physical, has changed their life. It's written by Sibone and Fallon, and it is a small cast, which is, I think, important, because it's a very intimate play and you're drawn straight into the production from the very beginning. I would recommend, if you're going, perhaps to check out a restaurant which is just up the road there called Central Kitchen. They have a special tasting menu. And I think one of the joys when I went, which was the opening evening, is that you are straight away mingling with theatregoers. And I actually learned quite a bit about the production even before the play itself began. It's a dramatic story. The first is called The Last Stand. And again, it has to do this time with physical injury, coming back, how the women see things. And of course, in this case, a very sad breakup of a marriage. And then The Gold Star, again, how the decorated really have different visions of what it means. You know, when the men are gone, it reminded me in some ways of the war poetry of Wilfred Owen. And if you've been through wars, in my case, the memories of people coming back after Vietnam were strong on my mind. But if you've been at any of these regatherings or reunions, there is both a glory and a sadness. And I think today, particularly when we are dealing with new diagnoses from traumatic stress disorder and recognition that you can look okay on the outside, but the injury comes in the soul, it comes in the mind, it comes in the brain. This is a play for our times. I highly recommend it. It's at the Z Space at a good contact point. If you want to find out more information, is the website www.zspace.org. The play is called Word for Word, and it runs until February 24.
Excellent. Thanks for sharing that, Peter. Kurt Bodden's show, Steve Seabrook, Better Than You, runs starting next week through the 30th at the Marsh on Valencia Street. Go to themarsh.org. Kurt, any last thoughts for us today?
Well, at the risk of going from the sublime to the ridiculous, as Peter was speaking there about the feelings, the sort of subtext feelings below what the public face, I was thinking maybe part of the reason I'm not in a more romantic mood on Valentine's Day is that I came from a tech rehearsal this morning, and Steve Seabrook, my character, you also get to see him behind the scenes. You sort of see the man behind the man occasionally, and his love life is not going as well as he might wish, and his career aspirations are not going quite as well either. So you see the public man very confident, and then he's got some vulnerabilities and weaknesses behind the curtain, so to speak.
Okay. So we go from the green room to the bedroom and finally to the front room.
Very nice.
Where would you get stuck, preferably?
Peter Robinson, thank you always for your insight, especially into the Valentine's Day situation
thank
of
you, David.
2013.
Good to be here. Mm-hmm.
Kurt Bodden, and best of luck with your run here in San Francisco and where it takes you beyond.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, too, to Neil Swinkles for extra assistance in preparing today's show. Leave you with another great lady of song, Dinah Washington, and I've Got You Under My Skin for today's open air. More music of Cole Porter.
the sake of having you near, in spite of the warning voice that comes in the night and repeats in my ear. Each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. Yes, I've got you.
Great Dinah Washington with I've Got You Under My Skin. Cole Porter tune, and some of the fantastic trumpet playing you heard was by a trio of some of the best trumpeters that are or were Clark Terry, Maynard Ferguson, and Clifford Brown. I'm David LaTulippe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Stay tuned for an hour of news from the BBC next.